My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
We go straight into round one, which tests respective vocabularies. So for 2 marks, can you give me the meaning of the following words? Anne Scott James, ecumenical. And you can start that either with an O-E or an E. Ecumenical.
Well, ecumenical year was when all the princes of the various Christian churches decided to stick their differences. So I think it means an agreement between the various Christian churches.
If they ever did agree, all the various churches, they could be investigated by the Monopolies Commission.
Yes, you haven't got the...
Is it come from oikios, a house? Or
yes, it does.
Like that?
And you've nearly got that, and by saying that it's all the princes of all
it's
the churches...
It's an assembly, is it, of the churches of the Christian world? I can't...
That's right, that's what I wanted number two. It's an ecclesiastical adjective. It means belonging to or representing the entire Christian world or the universal church, and it comes from a Greek phrase which means the inhabited world. 2 marks. Frank Muir, Gregory powder.
Gregory powder is dried or powdered rhubarb.
Yes.
And got its name from... it was invented by Pope Gregory, and the roarings and the sounds and the intestines, like little miniature men on bicycles, on motorcycles roaring round, was the origin of the phrase the Gregorian chant. It's a laxative powder, 18th century laxative powder.
If you'll drop your Pope, I'll give you 2 marks.
Oh, yeah, well, with pleasure. Not very ecumenical, really.
I think that's probably good enough. It was a laxative, the compounded powder of rhubarb, and I think they often added nasty things like magnesia and ginger as well. And there was a Scottish physician, Dr. James Gregory, who died in 1821, who was alleged to have invented it, and sometimes called Gregory's powder.
Sometimes called rhubarb a go-go.
Yes, yes, do even better. Well, now, Dennis Powell, your word is bellomancy. B-E-L-O-M-A-N-C-Y. Bellomancy.
Would it be indiscreet to ask if that comes from the Greek?
Yes, it does.
Comes from the Greek. So the B really can be pronounced in modern Greek as a V. Bellomancy.
I think very possible. So you know much more about modern Greek than I am.
In modern Greek, phelos is an arrow.
Yes, it'll do. Mm. That's fine.
And mancy is prophesying.
Yes. Put those together.
You prophesy with arrows.
You do.
Do you?
Yes, just so.
I never have.
No, it's a very
never
odd
tried.
Kind. And I
The modern view is as well, it's a lot of bull.
Well, Dillis's impeccable knowledge of Greek derivations has got her there. Divination by means of arrows. Now, this sounds very improbable, but I'm told that you put different kinds of advice on little slips of paper or parchment, and you tied those onto the arrow. And the arrow that was shot farthest, you took the advice written on that arrow. You must have got some very odd results, I think. That's bellomancy. Sorry. Dennis Norton, snip, snap, snorum.
Snip, snap, snorum?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an ancient word for what happens if you fall asleep in the barber's chair.
Think in terms of games.
Oh.
In games?
Yeah.
Oh, is it one of those...
Come on.
Card game? Mm-hmm.
Snap. It's just a full name for snap.
Is it? A snip is obviously cutting the cards.
Snap is when you get 2 cards the same.
Yeah, 2 cards.
Snorm is when you fall asleep. It's also boring.
Yeah.
One out of two for ingenuity. It's a round game of cards, and the players, who I think are fairly young players, on turning up the requisite cards, call out Snip, Snap, or Snorum. It appears to be Low German in origin, but I don't know what that means.
Well,
one mark. Well, at this point,
by a German midget.
Might have been that. I think it goes on High Cockalorum, but I never knew what that meant either. But we'll go on.
Don't let's pursue that.
No, I think not.
Different game altogether. No?
But at this point, I give Dennis and Frank a quotation each to think about for their stories in the last round. And Dennis, yours is The Pirates of Penzance. And for you, Frank, He Who Hesitates is Lost. Now, round two is a round of insults, or near insults. And these are uncharitable remarks made by the famous about the famous. For two marks, of whom was the following said or written, and by whom. Beginning with Anne Scott James. He has occasional flashes of silence that make his conversation perfectly delightful.
Was it said about Beau Brummel?
No, I think you've got to think a little as the object. Somebody who lived rather longer than Beau Brummel, if I remember rightly. But you've had this chap quite often, and he was a very celebrated wit.
All wits.
Sydney Smith.
Yes. Well done.
And, well, we haven't really done wrong.
Think who, of whom he might have been speaking.
Well, is he speaking about royalty?
No, somebody rather pompous, I suppose, really. They were a very good writer, but slightly pompous one.
Macaulay?
Yes. It was Sidney Smith said it of Macaulay, and it comes in Lady Holland's memoirs. Now, Frank Miller, he is, and that's in inverted commas, or in brackets, sorry, he is an archangel a little damaged.
Is that in a letter?
Yes.
By Charles Lamb.
Done.
After attending, I think it was, I'm not sure, it was a conversation or a reading from Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Yes, absolutely right. Charles Lamb is writing to Wordsworth and about Coleridge, with whom he also had a fairly voluminous correspondence. His face, when he repeats his verses, hath its ancient glory, an archangel a little damaged. From a nice phrase. Two marks, well done. Dennis Powell, he became a sort of village atheist, brooding and blaspheming over the village idiot.
Byron.
Now, later than that.
Later
than that.
Writing,
Byron. He wrote some poetry, but mainly I think about his prose, yes.
Shaw-like.
It's about the same time, yes.
About the same time.
I think you'd better get a bit westwards. I'm in the West Country.
In the West Country?
Hardy.
Yes.
Oh. Well, who else? Who else? How brilliant.
Hardy it is, but who is speaking?
Who's speaking?
Ah.
Well, now.
Ah. Somebody who didn't like Hardy.
Yes.
Well, he tended to speak in paradoxes.
Speaking in paradoxes? Chesterton?
Yes. Well done.
And without help.
No, one and a half. You don't get more than one and a half. It's G.K. Chesterton in his The Victorian Age in Literature, writing, I think, rather unkindly about Thomas Hardy. And he said Hardy went down to botanize in the swamp while Meredith climbed towards the sun. I think judgment would hardly be upheld today. Now, back to Dennis Norden. He is a sophistical rhetorician inebriated with the exuberance of his own verbosity.
Well, that was said twice to my... It was quoted by Churchill.
Yes.
And I think it was originally said by Disraeli, probably of Gladstone.
Quite right, yep. Yeah. Disraeli, speaking rather surprisingly, at the riding school, Knightsbridge, in 1878, 27th of July. Two marks. Well, now we have a round of word differences, and this is a question of precise definition. I want, for two marks, you to tell me, the, as exactly as you can, the differences in meaning between these words, which are very nearly, but not quite, synonymous. Anne Scott James, easy and simple.
There's a lot of meanings easy, aren't there?
I know.
At enormous length. Easy is something which is simple to do, and simple is implied in is the quality of the thing itself, isn't it?
Yes.
I think you could say it is easy to make a bad joke. It's inherent in the noun simple, isn't it?
I think that's right. Yes, I think that's true. Easy, on the whole, means performing something with ease. It gives no trouble. It is done with comfort. It presents few difficulties and so on. Simple tends to mean that which is mentally undemanding. It rather means straightforward. It can mean elementary. It means you don't require practically any mental thought at all in order to get there. I think that'd be the two. Now, Frank Muir, rich and wealthy.
Both alien words, as far as I'm concerned. Rich and wealthy. There's a there is a difference in use, isn't there? Because one is rich qualitative, and wealthy quantitative.
Yes, I think that would come in.
You say a wealth of detail means a lot of it. And you say it's rich in detail.
Yeah.
Means what's there is very good.
Yes, I think that's it. Now, translate that into monetary terms.
Il y a wealthy means you've got a lot of money, and rich means you've got a lot of good money.
How long have you had it?
Well, I think wealthy is supposed to be a non-you way of saying rich.
That's right.
Referring to money.
That's what I wanted. Yes. A duke could be rich, but the self-made man tends to be called wealthy.
Poor and skint.
Yes.
One is occasional and the other is permanent.
Now, dear Lisbeth, great and large.
Well, great can have a kind of aesthetic meaning, a great writer.
Yes.
It's not, and large means in size. Large is a physical word.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And great can be a moral or aesthetic phrase.
That's right. You don't talk about large Britain, what you talk about Great Britain, don't you, if you want to. Yes, is it? Great is an emotive word, and large is much more factual, and great has undertones of importance or distinction. Large simply means you're pretty big. And now, Dennis Norton, clever and intelligent.
Well, that I think that, again, is a kind of modish thing. One would rather be called intelligent than be called clever, at least today.
No,
one
why?
Would, because intelligent, being called intelligent, particularly if you're not, has an undertone of being understanding and concerned, whereas clever has a feeling of being almost too clever by half. You know that thing, if all the good people were clever and all who were clever were good, this world would be better than ever we thought that it possibly could. But somehow it's seldom, if ever, that things work out just as they should, because the good are so rude to the clever and the clever so hard on the good.
I can add nothing to that except to give it two marks. Now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations which I gave Dennis and Frank at the beginning of the program. And on this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Dennis, your quotation was The Pirates of Penzance, which is, of course, a Gilbert and Sullivan opera.
When I went into a cafe the other day and said to the man behind the counter, could I have a hamburger, please? He said, do you want to eat it here or take it away? And I said, well, with a bit of luck, I'd like to do both. Well, now, I mentioned that because what it emphasizes is the strange phenomenon which has absolutely revolutionized British eating habits: take away foods. Now, that is a completely new development. There's so many varieties of takeaway food, you can get kebab. That's a fancy name for what, when you get it home, turns out to be nothing but a fry-up on a skewer. And still in the East, there's the Indian takeaways, which offer chapatis and poppadoms and curry with a singe on top. And there's Japanese takeaways. I don't really know what they sell. I imagine it must be those karate chops we keep hearing about. And then the most successful of all are the Chinese takeaways. Our local one has done so well, they've bought a whacking great limousine to make deliveries in. We call it the Rolls Royce. However, what you may have noticed about all these things, they have one common factor, all these takeaway places, and that is that the food they offer are all of foreign origin. And that's why I think a mate of mine called Ben is on to what could well turn out to be a gold mine. Because he has an idea for opening a shop that will sell takeaway steak and kidney pies. Real English steak and kidney pies, which are to be cooked by his elderly Aunt M and his elderly Aunt B. Now, unfortunately, his plans have suffered a setback. You see, like all simple, old-fashioned aunties, Auntie M and Auntie B will cook only with the very best ingredients. And where steak and kidney pie is concerned, that means the very best steak and the very best kidneys. Now, have you any idea what that costs? There are those who will deny that meat is that expensive. My butcher does. And his butler. And his two undergardeners. Nevertheless, there was a story in the paper the other day about a gang of thieves who broke into a Smithfield Market cold store, stole a quantity of fillet steak to the value of £68,000 and got away in a Volkswagen. So you'll perhaps appreciate why it is that Ben's plan for Auntie M and Auntie B's takeaway steak and kidney pie palace, although it's a good idea in theory, in practice what it looks like is that enough steak and kidney pies to feed four people will work out the rate of something like £9.76. But the ironic thing is that my poor friend looks like losing a fortune on the very thing that made Gilbert and Sullivan gain a fortune. In other words, the pie rates of Ben's aunts.
Well, I shall always remember the curry with the singe on top. And we now go back to Faulkner with his quotation, if you remember. He who hesitates is lost, which I think is a very, very old proverb.
I don't know how many people listening to this program, there must be literally dozens, are going to Ian and Cynthia Hope Willoughby's fancy dress party tomorrow. But any of you are listening who are going, then I'm going to tell you something which will make somebody there happy. they have sort of schemes, and they always have this rule, you have to come as something. So this year the invitation came, and it was come as a sin. Well, I thought, you know, I must be able to devise a costume immediately recognisable. So I paraded myself in front of my wife and said, what are you going as? And she said, I'm going as lust. And she showed me her costume. I must say, it was pretty good. It was immediately recognisable after about an hour and an explanation in writing. It was a pair of flame-coloured tights on which she'd embroidered, or was going to have embroidered, slogans like, kiss me quick, I'm nearly 40. And this represented lust, you see. I didn't hold out much hopes for her, but I thought very carefully about mine, and I got my daughter's old, very long fur coat, which she'd bought for 1 and 9 at the White Elephant stall in the village market. I buttoned that up at the neck, and I sewed the skirts together to make sort of trousers. And I put my gum boots on, and I cut 2 wedges in the gum boot, the toes of the gum boot, and I was going as a sloth. And I thought, if I hang upside down with my fur coat on, and if you you have to climb up on a step ladder, but if you hook your toes in the gum boots over the edge of a door, you can really hang quite reasonably. There's a tendency to get bloodshot hair after that. But it is not dangerous at all unless somebody comes rushing in the door, which happened. And I was not only was my back of my head bumped against the wall, but I came out of my gum boots and landed on my head. And the, you know, when the doctor had given me sedatives, the twitching, this was yesterday, the twitching stopped. But he said, you mustn't go to go out, you must take it very calmly. It's okay to do my word, because that's no problem, you know, just sitting there pretending you know things. He said, but you can't go tomorrow to the party. And I thought, well, I can't go. And I explained to my wife, I said, why did you come rushing in like that? She said, the most terrible thing. So I took my red tights, my flame-coloured, lustful tights, through to be embroidered with Kiss Me Quick, I'm Nearly 40, to the woman who does all the fancy dress, a very nice little needlewoman of Cynthia's. And she'd delivered the wrong ones. And my wife hadn't got her flame tights embroidered with Kiss Me Quick, I'm Nearly 40. She'd got a voluminous pair of trousers with a slice of bacon stitched onto the kneecap. Obviously gluttony, you see. And her tights are gone. The fellow had obviously got hers, so she couldn't go to the party either. So neither of us are going to the party, which is absolutely marvellous. But if anybody is, any of you in the audience tonight, or anybody listening, is going to Ian and Cynthia's party tomorrow, that fat chap is going to have, who left his trousers with a slice of bacon, is going to have my wife's tights on. And you know who he's meant to be. So at least recognise him instantly and make his evening. All you've got to remember is the garment she was wearing. Flame, tights, embroidered. And so when you get in tomorrow night, look round all the company, and he who has her tights is lust. Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, and it's a close vote too, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories, and he and Anne Scott-James also just win the entire contest this evening. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott-James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.